Welcome to Rehab Cast. This is the October 2020 edition of Rehab Cast from the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. In this episode, you're going to be hearing from Mark Shearer and Yelena Bodian. They are both authors of the new case definition and diagnostic criteria of the post-traumatic confusional state. And following that, we're going to be getting all the details of ACRM 2020. That's the upcoming, right around the corner, international conference, now online. For that interview, we'll be hearing directly from Pamela Roberts, current president of ACRM. And now moving on to our first interview. Joining us now on the Rehab Cast, we have two authors from a new paper in the Archives of Physical Medicine Rehabilitation on the post-traumatic confusional state, a case definition and diagnostic criteria. As you'll hear over the course of this conversation, this is a product of a large team that's been working on this for a number of years. And joining us from that team is Mark Shearer and Yelena Bodian. Mark is Associate VP for Research at Tier Memorial Hermann. He is Clinical Professor of PM&R at Baylor College of Medicine in the University of Texas Medical School at Houston. Yelena is Research Scientist in the Department of Physical Medicine Rehabilitation at Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital and the Department of Neurology at Massachusetts General. Thanks to both of you for joining us in the Rehabcast.
Thanks for the opportunity.
All right, guys. So this paper was a baby long in the making,
it appears,
reaching all the way back into the mists of time of 2013. Were both of you involved at the very beginning?
Well, I started really on this project in late 2012. Had a conversation with Joe Giacino about doing a paper that would follow on to the minimally conscious state case definition paper. And we were conceiving post-traumatic confusion as part of the continuum of recovery of consciousness after traumatic brain injury. So from there, I talked to Risa, not to say Richardson, who at the time was the a chairperson of the Disorders of Consciousness ISIG of ACRM, and we formed a confusion work group, invited Doug Katz initially to co-lead the paper. Yelena came in a little bit later in the process, and a number of outstanding physicians, neuropsychologists, speech language pathologists, others helped with the project along the way.
So this is the project that caused the formation then of that extra special interest group in ACRM. Is that right?
Right, the confusion subgroup, right.
Okay.
And we are going to continue. Having formed, we have a reason to be now, so we're going to continue to work on other papers related mm-hmm. to post-traumatic confusion to help improve understanding and hopefully improve assessment and eventually treatment options.
These work groups have been very productive lately. This podcast featured the work product of that DOC work group in terms of some criteria for quality DOC programs to follow and so forth, and interviewed Joe Giacino on that. So that's good. It looks like that system is definitely working.
Yes. As ACRM provides a great opportunity to collaborate with your colleagues, all the people I've worked with all the years that I've been working in research on traumatic brain injury, they're pretty much all ACRM members and involved with the BI ISIC, the Disorders of Consciousness Group, and now the Confusion Group.
Very good.
I'll just add that as a more junior member in this group, it was a really incredible experience to be taken under the wing of some of the more senior scientists in this project and in other projects. And I think, just as you said, Dr. Vox, that this forum provides the opportunity for junior investigators like myself to really learn and to also take leadership roles on some of these projects. So I would have to echo what Dr. Scheer said and what you said about the BI ISA groups being highly productive, but also very nurturing of junior scientists.
Now we're going to get into the meat of the matter here shortly, but on some of these preliminaries, I have one other question for you guys. Would one of you tell us about the Galveston Brain Injury Conference and what that is? Because I see that was critical to this as well, a couple of in-person meetings there kind of later in the phase of development of this.
Why don't you do that, Yolanda?
Sure. So the Galveston meeting provides an opportunity for very focused in-person meetings to take place amongst groups that have works in progress that would benefit from a collaborative effort to come together in one place and kind of hammer out projects and to help them kind of reach the finish line. And so for our group, we really needed kind of a place and a time to meet to carry out some of the Delphi processes that were involved in creating the case definition for the post-traumatic confusional state. And we were able to do that through a couple of meetings at Galveston over a couple of years. And they were hugely helpful because they kind of forced everyone to come together to the same place and to focus just on this one question in particular and really push the project forward substantially.
As I understand it, that's a bit of a unique conference in terms of kind of it's a smaller crowd, invite only and so forth. Is that right?
That's correct. And I think the key thing, you know, we've all gotten used to all of these virtual types of meeting, but when you're really trying to get to decisions and incorporate everyone's point of view, it's just so much easier to do that in a face-to-face meeting, even with the technology. When you have 15 people trying to contribute to a conversation, you know, it's much harder to include everybody online than it is when you can see them in the room and, you know, they're waving their hand. And
yeah, don't get me started on these Zoom rooms, man.
The opportunity provided by the Moody Foundation and the Allied Health Department at UTMB was just a great opportunity. It really helped move the project along.
Well, so let's do start getting to the meat of the matter and what the problem is in the first place. I mean, it is, I suppose, fascinating. Of course, it's discussed in the paper, but, you know, obviously, when it comes to DOC, you know, that's kind of generally viewed as more the mystery element of TBI and so forth in these phases, coma, vegetative, and minimally conscious, and obviously minimally conscious being more recently defined and so forth. But it is fascinating, I guess, historically, that the phase of TBI recovery, which probably everyone I would hope be most familiar with, the so-called confusional stage, is so confusing in and of itself, and with all these different definitions and so forth, and just very messy in that regard, and perhaps a lot of disagreement in the field over what it is, which hopefully this paper will start to help resolve. But would you tell us a little bit about that history as you understand it? I mean, it's kind of interesting that, again, MCS, you know, just emerging as something that folks are generally recognizing, you know, that should be perhaps more clearly defined and defined first, and then something that hopefully all the old timers and everybody recognizes as the meat of the matter.
Well, the term post-traumatic amnesia was coined by Dr. Richie Russell and Dr. Charles Simon back in the 1930s. And in their articles, they described a complex neurobehavioral state that had elements of confusion, cognitive impairment, perceptual distortions, disturbances of arousal, and so forth. And over the years, there began to be a focus more on the cognitive aspects of post-traumatic confusion. There were some excellent articles done by Harvey Levin and his group on preserved cognitive abilities that could be detected in persons who were in post-traumatic amnesia. And the assessment techniques focused almost exclusively on disorientation and perhaps recognition memory. And lots of us clinicians who were working on the units were aware that these patients, in addition to being disoriented and having memory impairment, had a broad range of cognitive impairments, had other behavioral disturbances, restlessness, impulsivity, labile affect, in some cases, delusional thinking, perceptual disturbances, a hallmark feature is fluctuation. So we thought that it was important to kind of reconceptualize the state and ensure that people are thinking about all of those elements. And a big hallmark in this movement was a paper published by Don Stuss and his colleagues in 1999, where the term post-traumatic confusional state was coined. And that had a big influence on our thinking, certainly contributed to development of this team to work on this paper.
I see Don passed away last year, right? And he did come up with this term, is involved in the process. You'll just discuss his work in the paper here. He was really a great in the field.
Absolutely. And just such a generous person. During the time that he was working on this project, he was contending with illness and was just very generous in giving up his time and sharing his conceptualizations. His work had focused a great deal on the patterns of cognitive recovery in persons in a confusional state. But he was very open to looking at these other associated neurobehavioral features. And I should mention John Corrigan also, because his early work on agitation, had as one of its findings the association between resolution of agitation and recovery of orientation in patients in recovery from traumatic brain injury. So lots of people, you always stand on the work of other people, and certainly this project and our thinking about it was informed by a ton of work done by other people.
Yelena, would you tell us a little bit about the architecture of how this case definition was derived?
Sure. So we began in the early stages in 2012, 2013 with a major literature review of the field, looking for any articles, abstracts that we could find that had anything to do with post-traumatic amnesia, post-traumatic confusional state, and so forth. We worked in pairs to narrow those abstracts down to those that met a specific inclusion criteria, pulled those abstracts and did a systematic review of that literature with specific elements abstracted to address the different phenomenological features of the post-traumatic confusional state. And we then had a Delphi process that we spoke about briefly at Galveston, where we worked out the 6 to 7 components of the confusional state definition and voted up to 3 times on each aspect of the definition until we came to a consensus within our group. And then just most recently, we reevaluated the literature to bring it up to date to through 2018 and added any type of information that was available up in the most recent years into the definition, although fortunately the actual definition didn't have to change from the second literature review. We didn't have any articles that substantially edited the definition, but we did find articles that were able to support the definition that we came up with in Galveston.
And talk about whittling down from, like, what is this, 2,466 abstracts, 181 articles. all down to ultimately only 44 being used in the course of this case definition. What's that? Those inclusion exclusion criteria for quality research in this area. What was the toughest one that seemed to just rule out virtually everything you looked at?
That is a great question. I have to think through which exclusion criteria were the most common. We did exclude articles that were primarily focused on the prognostic aspects of post-traumatic amnesia. So that took out a chunk of articles. We also had many articles that looked at some features of very early brain injury, looking at that didn't really have to do with the confusional state or post-traumatic amnesia as a whole, but got pulled out because some of the other search features. It was quite an arduous process, but fortunately the abstract reviews, they're very short. And so you're able to pretty quickly figure out which articles are in and out. We also had, exclusion criteria for how many subjects had to be in an article, and that will whittle down some of the case series as well.
Well, it really emphasizes how important that, you know, expert clinician opinion and everything, proves to be, when the body of, you know, the high quality literature, I suppose, is that small. And one thing that you discuss in here is the fact that there's this universal neglect for confabulation in particular, which folks in the field generally recognize as an important feature, but somehow isn't reflected in the literature. What do y'all think is the possible explanation for that?
I can say from our own work in developing a measure that we've used, the confusion assessment protocol, we initially had an item that sought to rate confabulation, but we found that it was very difficult to get inter-rater reliability on that item. What seemed like confabulation to some people seemed like delusional thinking to other people, or verbal restlessness, or some other phenomenon. And that is a challenge in these assessments. So one of the key features is fluctuation. And, in our research, we thought we had a clear idea of what fluctuation looked like. And we see that other people, you know, kind of look at that differently. That's actually one of the implications of the paper, is that particularly these behavioral ratings need to be improved so that we have more accurate and consistent measurement, because improvement on any of these behavioral features, such as fluctuation in particular, is important to detect, and definitely any decline is important to detect, because absent complications, we expect to see a recovering course in these patients, and it's important to detect any change that's not a positive change, so that we can look and see what the causes might be.
And I suppose it's important to point out that no one single paper of those that that you reviewed was like a Rosetta Stone ultimately for what everyone agreed is this kind of key definition, that it is a process of melding together that data, the expert opinion through this process, but no single paper emphasized all of what y'all decided were the 9 key criteria for the confusional state. Let's turn to that and look at this definition now. It's kind of divided between core criteria and additional criteria, which may be in the confusional state as well. Of those 4 key criteria which need to be shown, I'm going to kind of list those briefly, and let's discuss those a bit here. So disturbances of attention, disorientation, disturbances of memory, and fluctuation. So a person who's said to be in the post-traumatic confusional state needs to display all of these. Perhaps self-evident to those in this podcast listening to some extent who are in the field, but I imagine there's a lot of debate, I would expect, about what are, the key 4. If y'all could kind of give us a little bit of your view of over why the consensus is ultimately why these are the most defining, and then we'll kind of look into some of the additional features that ultimately are decided, well, more or less. You know, a given confusional patient might not be confabulating, certainly, or showing delusions, but really does need to have this fluctuation, disturbance of memory, and so forth.
I can talk a little bit to some of the questions that you just brought up. So, and we can start with fluctuations. So we felt that fluctuation is one of the core features, you know, in large part because of the impact that it can have on rehabilitation and treatment and therapies, and it can be it can really disturb the ability to have a treatment and plan in place that is consistent and progressing from day to day. And certainly, especially, you know, for families who see, you know, a loved one looking pretty good one day, or maybe even in 1 hour, and then terrible the next day, it's very distressing. And it kind of, I think, sets apart the post-traumatic confusional state from something that's more of like a neurocognitive disorder after TBI. I think that there's a lot of conversation about whether the memory and the orientation impairments are really attributable to attention or separate constructs, but we felt that in the literature there was enough evidence to support that, in fact, attention and impairments in attention and memory and orientation were separatable in this disorder. So I think that those four key features are those which, you know, essentially every patient who is emerging from a minimally conscious state or is in a confusional state is going to present with. And we certainly found the most literature to support these four key features.
Along these lines, with, you know, these four key features and emphasizing that memory is only one of them, and the purpose of this paper, again, to provide, endorse this particular term, post-traumatic confusional state, to provide this case definition, is it time to dump PTA altogether?
We consider post-traumatic amnesia to be a sub-aspect of the post-traumatic confusional state. So impairment of the ability to form and later recall new memories is one of the most commonly observed features of persons who have sustained traumatic brain injury. And in fact, patients who have sustained very mild injuries will frequently have a period of time, which might be very brief, even just minutes, in which they don't recall the events that are happening around them. Our son sustained a concussion when he fell off a horse one time, and you know, he seemed fine, but then all of a sudden he looked perplexed and he did not understand why he was standing on the ground instead of being on the horse. And, you know, just that, you know, minor injury resulted in a very brief disruption of his ability to form those memories and then recall them shortly thereafter. Now, in those mild injuries, we usually don't see a full-blown confusional syndrome, but just to highlight that memory is a key feature, and that's probably why it attracted so much attention. From the standpoint of a neuropsychologist, memory is one of the easiest things to measure. So I wonder if that's part of the reason that it got a lot of attention, because some of these other features are much more challenging. I mean, we talked about confabulation, fluctuation, disturbances of arousal. To get consensus on what is normal arousal versus hypo-aroused, hyper-aroused, you know, it can be somewhat challenging. But people who are working with these patients and see the impact that this behavior has on the nursing unit, where a patient may have a high intensity of nursing because the patient is hyper-aroused at night, will not go to sleep, is trying to get out of the bed because of restlessness. You know, these are key features that really affect treatment and safety, and also impact on the families' emotional distress when they come to visit their loved one.
Now, besides the core features that everyone has to show, patients can have these others, which are thought to be important enough to highlight. I do want to ask you, what about even more than these? I'm sure you'd agree, but emotional and or behavioral disturbances, sleep-wake cycle disturbance, delusions, perceptual disturbance, confabulation. Probably there's more debate in this section about what should be included or excluded as defining enough here. I guess we don't have time to discuss each of these in depth, but Yelena, perhaps if you could give me your view of these, why this particular collection do you think that the entire group settled on as the most important for the secondary grouping?
I think that for most of them, all except for confabulation, there was strong evidence to support that they occurred, during this period of recovery from traumatic brain injury that accompanies post-traumatic amnesia and some of the other symptoms associated with the confusional state. So we had, I think probably the most evidence for emotional and behavioral disturbance and, agitation, as Dr. Scheer mentioned, as well as the sleep-wake cycles, a little bit less evidence in the literature for delusions and perceptual disturbance. I think for confabulation, and Dr. Scheer can speak a little more to this, this was really based on the consensus opinion. I don't believe we found a single article to support confabulation as one of the features of the post-traumatic confusional state, but it was strongly felt by all of the clinicians in the group who work with these patients very closely that it very often accompanies this confusional state, despite the fact that it hasn't been studied in depth. And I think that what we hope for this paper is that going forward, this definition is, because it now exists, is going to be studied in depth. And so we anticipate that as folks take on this definition and try to really find more support for it, that even some of these symptoms that didn't have as much evidence are going to come out as being important in this syndrome.
And there are certainly some kind of housekeeping things that go along with this definition as well. The fact that it can't be explained by another medical condition or psychiatric disorder and so forth. And that these impairments need to in some way, limit person's functional independence. Another key factor is really defining the higher and lower bounds of the confusional state. And I gather it kind of gets messy there again. To the extent that, what is that precise moment of emergence from MCS into confusional? And then, exactly how impaired must you be to be confusional versus post-confusional but impaired? I'd love to get both your views on that. Obviously, the paper discusses it to a certain extent, but I gather these are areas that certainly need to be explored further. Let's start with that MCS to confusional transition. What are the kind of the contours of the debate there?
So I'll take that one on a little bit. So we really had a lot of questions about how to, define the upper and the lower boundary. Ultimately, the lower boundary for the post-traumatic confusional state was largely defined by the upper boundary of the minimally conscious state. And of course, there's still debate in the literature on what exactly should define the upper boundary of the minimally conscious state. But we felt that if the argument that we were making was that PTCS is follows on to MCS and is part of the disorders of consciousness spectrum as a whole, that the upper boundary of MCS, and so the two features of that being consistent, reliable, accurate communication and functional object use, could form the lower boundary of the post-traumatic confusional state.
And then as we're getting to that higher level, how do we contextualize what's that key transitional moment between confusional and now we've got some just chronic impairments related to this TBI?
So this is a big challenge and an area where additional work is needed. Just as with the minimally conscious state, we believe that when persons are emerging from the confusional state, it should indicate an improvement in functional ability. So the behavioral repertoire of minimally conscious patients is less extensive. So we can look at a couple of things and have great diagnostic accuracy. So the functional communication and functional use of object item from the coma recovery scale revised and, you know, from the case definition provide that basis. So when a person is recovering from confusion, what are the functional indicators of that? So we look at big classes of behaviors that are important for a person to be functional and to transition to another level of care, or to clearly indicate that they are substantially improved. So we looked at the ability to engage in social interactions. Those could be simple social interactions, but the ability to have awareness of social context, at least to a limited degree, and be able to effectively interact with another person. Another important aspect is safety. So while persons who have just recovered from the confusional state have some residual impairment of memory, it's important that they have sufficient memory to retain safety instructions. So a person who recovers to the point that they can recall that their balance is impaired and doesn't attempt to, you know, come to standing without assistance, that would be an important hallmark. So we think future research will result in performance measures of memory, attention, and so forth that will have cut scores that will be revealing in this regard. But we think that another approach is to develop descriptions of behavioral competencies that are seen in persons who are in the period of continued recovery after resolution of confusion, but would be unlikely to be accomplished by a person who was still in a confusional state. This is an opportunity for our younger researchers and clinicians to really make a big contribution, because just as we've seen with disorders of consciousness, or the classic disorders of consciousness, we have some concern that a person's status as far as confused, non-confused, could also be a factor in determining their access to additional care. So accurate diagnosis isn't just, you know, for clinical convenience. It could have major implications about the institutional placement, whether the person goes to a residential placement, you know, what their access is to outpatient treatment after discharge from inpatient services, and so forth.
Well, I'm still going to try to get one of you to make a little bit of news in this interview. Let me try another zinger question. I asked you earlier, is it time to dump PTA altogether? And I think ultimately, you know, the politically correct way to say it is that this perhaps subsumes PTA per se. Obviously, it's a little bit more of a discrete aspect of the confusional state. Let's try to get one of you on record. What is now the utility of the Rancho scale? When we're looking at the definitions now that we're writing of VS, MCS, and so forth, and now the confusional state, is the Rancho scale perhaps a workhorse that has done us well over a few decades, but perhaps is holding back a greater understanding of what's happening in those Rancho scale phases 4, 5, and 6?
You know, I myself have never been a big fan of the Rancho scale, because the behavioral competencies seen at the different levels are overlapping. So it doesn't really give you a clear cut point. And the scale was originally developed just to indicate when a person recovering from traumatic brain injury was ready to begin treatment. It was developed by a speech language pathologist whose name escaped me now, but a long time ago when I first started in brain injury rehab. So I think the utility is if you're working in a team where everybody is familiar with that scale and has a similar understanding of the categories, then it can make communication more efficient. And not to get to something totally mundane, but staffing time in inpatient rehab programs has gotten cut and cut and cut during my 35-year career in this business. And things like everyone knowing disorders of consciousness terminology, knowing, you know, the implications of the confusional state, or, you know, being familiar with the Rancho scale can facilitate an ease of communication that helps speed up the team conference process. The only concern I have about that is that some people use behavioral labels that really have almost no specificity. So, for example, on the post-traumatic confusional state, restlessness is one of the criteria. But in a clinical setting, I want to know, okay, what is the specific manifestation that you're seeing that leads you to believe that the patient is restless? You know, because that may have a more straightforward implication for management than kind of grossly categorizing the behavior. So I guess it's kind of, you know, we have to summarize to some degree, but have enough specificity on the issues that guide treatment so that we're, you know, providing the very best care.
Okay. Very diplomatic. All right. Yelena, let's get your opinion.
So, you know, I think there, so the definition of the post-traumatic confusional state, I think, lends itself well to a measure that is going to have an integration of both performance-based and observational aspects. So the confusion assessment protocol is one such measure, but as we know, there's no single measure that addresses every single aspect of the post-traumatic confusional definition. Similarly, the Rancho scale, which is, you know, primarily based on observation, doesn't have any performance-based aspects of it per se, doesn't address every aspect of the post-traumatic confusional state. So I think the answer to this question is not that this definition is going to subsume or kind of make irrelevant the Rancho scale, but that what it's really going to do is pave the way for the development of a measure that better addresses this particular aspect of recovery from the post-traumatic, recovery from traumatic brain injury. I think that there will, as Dr. Scheer suggested, there will always be a place for an observational measure that can be quick to abstract from a medical record, that can be quick to kind of discuss in team conferences, kind of similar to the Glasgow Coma Scale as compared to the Coma Recovery Scale revised. So there's always going to be a place for maybe a measure like the Rancho Scale, like a quick and easy down and dirty measure. But I think that for a full understanding and measurement of the post-traumatic confusional state, we'll probably need a whole new measure to be developed and validated in the future.
And that's ultimately a big part of what this is about. Obviously, it will be useful in clinical care, but measurement, a definition that can actually be done in studies surrounding the confusional state. We're not only going to include people that meet this case definition in the study. I'm sure the archives will henceforth decline to publish studies related to the confusional state. I don't know, but we'll see. I'm sure that that in and of itself may be an area of controversy. But this is will be, I think, perhaps encourage more research into this state and help everyone recognize, hey, with only a handful of papers in the confusional state that reached the quality definition of this case definition, in many ways, sad but true, this is still a wide open area of brain injury science for all young researchers and old researchers alike to really get invested in.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. A big goal of our effort was to provide a research agenda for future work, but at the same time provide some greater clarity to guide research now and also clinical work. You asked earlier about exclusion of papers. Well, there was a surprising array of kind of unique, or let's at least I'll say very creative, criteria that were used to classify people as confused or in PTA. And some of those, you know, were based on just having one feature. And so we couldn't have confidence that the patient group being described was either confused or non-confused. So we, you know, had to exclude those, you know, a lot of papers on that basis.
Yeah, the confusional state has kind of been a Rorschach test for the clinician. I mean, you can see in these confused patients what you want to see to a certain extent, and it's going to result in this variety of takes on it, which unfortunately are really going to hold back the science. I mean, how can you possibly study, you know, medications, something as basic as that, you know, as related to this particular phase of injury if you don't know who you're including and excluding in the study and different people are disagreeing and so forth. So it's key work to advance in the field in that regard. So very important. Glad you guys invested the many years of effort into it. I hope all of our listeners got something good out of this podcast. We've blown through our allotted time, but I really appreciate both of you devoting the time to discuss this with us here today. I thank you both so much, and it was a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
You guys take care.
So joining us now on the Rehab Cast is Dr. Pamela Roberts. Dr. Roberts is 1 year into her 2 year term as president of ACRM. Dr. Roberts is based at Cedars-Sinai, where she is executive director to the Office of the Chief Medical Officer. She's also an executive director and professor in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. She's involved heavily in informatics, where she's co-director of the Division of Informatics there in the Department of Biomedical Sciences. And finally, she is an associate director for the Clinical Informatics Fellowship. Dr. Roberts is here today to discuss the ACRM's first, potentially only, but certainly first, virtual national, international medical conference in the wake of the COVID-19 epidemic. Dr. Roberts, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Fox.
Well, it has, of course, been quite a year. We can state that every week this year. This is by no means the first major medical conference at this point of the year to become virtual. And no doubt some of the attendees at this point in ACRM will certainly have had a wide variety of virtual and Zoom-like events ranging from lectures to classes to perhaps other educational sessions and so forth at this point. But this is potentially new and different still for those who've even done a wide variety of other events at this point in terms of the breadth of what's planned. There's been a lot of planning for this multi-day event, and we're going to kind of discuss here some of the nuts and bolts and how this came to be. Let's kind of start at the beginning. Obviously, the year didn't start out this way, and I'm sure plans were already heavily underway for the real-world event. Tell us kind of what your goals and thoughts were about converting this all to virtual and how that process has gone.
Well, it was a really big decision. We took everything under consideration, and then really looking at what's happening in the world. I don't think we had a choice. But, you know, one of the things we really wanted to make sure is that we didn't drop anything that we really have, especially our networking and our social abilities and people to be able to connect all over the world. So trying to figure out how to turn a multi-day, very jam-packed conference into virtual was quite the challenge. It took a lot of people from the office, from our volunteer leadership, from our other volunteers, from our 20-plus communities to really figure out how can we make this virtual conference probably not the same, but still a great event that people could really participate in and, most importantly, be able to continue to progress rehabilitation science.
Now, one of the cool things about it being a virtual that might be a little bit harder versus a real-world event is you can potentially sign right up until the moment of the event itself, potentially even during the event. Don't have to catch that last minute flight and so forth. So let's entice people a little bit. What are some of the highlights that you don't want to miss coming up in ACRM 2020?
Well, we have four great plenaries, which really we're going to be kicking off our first session, our first plenary with the 100-year anniversary of the Archives of Physical Medicine Rehabilitation will be Drs. Alan Heineman and Dr. Leighton Chan. It'll be incredible to hear about our long history of publishing rehabilitation science and being able to share that with the world. We also have wonderful special sessions that with our renowned opera singer, that will Renee Fleming in our arts and neurosciences. We again will have Ben Harder, who will be returning from U.S. News and World Report to talk about his great session he did last year, again with a panel to talk about what it does that mean for rehabilitation science and hopefully taking some of our suggestions that we provided last year. And we will continue to have our different communities. We'll have different ways and different events of being able to communicate not only their incredible science, but also being able to get that networking piece in.
Well, that is probably one of the harder challenges, I suppose, in terms of recreating what a real conference is like. Obviously, there's some spontaneous meetings going on. Someone might ask a question after a session, and somebody might go, huh, and approach that person afterwards and so forth. So that has to be a challenge in terms of making sure this isn't entirely didactic and just listening, but some of that interaction. What's that going to look like?
Well, we have something new that we're piloting. We have these new kind of like community blogs or forums that we have some of our community groups that we'll be piloting. It's new with our new membership system. So we're hoping that that will give some of the live social and interactive pieces. Plus, all of our community groups have had the opportunity to figure out to have early morning and late afternoon, because depending on where you're in the world, it could be morning one place and night another place. But to really be able to have some live chats, to be able to go over what had happened in the day, because we're not going to have that drive-by where you're walking down the hallway and you'll be able to see somebody, give them a hug, and be able to say what happened. So we had to figure out how to do that social networking and be able to get that. So each of the communities have designed it, and there is a on the web, you can click on the community and join in, and each community will have their dates and times that they'll be available. And there'll be people there live to chat with you, talk about you, keep moving, collaborate, figure out where we want to go in rehabilitation science.
Well, something just occurred to me along those lines, and I just wonder if perhaps you're aware. I haven't seen this platform yet myself, but are you able to tell who's logged in a given session, see that person's name, perhaps click on them and their profile, or send them a chat message or something like that?
Well, I won't by any means say I'm a technology expert, but some of those things will be available, but I don't know exactly. But we do have a help desk that will be available every day, and you can call into them, and they will you will get a live person to help you navigate. And if you have questions or want to get in touch with a particular person or a particular community, they will help you do it.
Now, what are kind of the nuts and bolts of getting set up to attend? What does that look like?
Well, when you register, they will be sending from the office your username and an access key. You're going to want to keep that email, but don't worry, in case you lose it, you can just put in your email of which you registered and you'll get it again. There will be a handy guide that acrm.org that will have the entire conference there. It's also on the website, and there will be a page that has the links to all the different communities, as well as there's ACRM help, of which you will be able to get a live person. We will have some new content launching. And just remember that we are, because the conference was to be in Atlanta, Georgia, so we will be on East Coast time. So some of us, especially overseas, or those of us in the West Coast, the early morning sessions will be very early for us.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah.
And there's also the app. And honestly, I just did it last night. Mm-hmm. If you go in and get the new app, you set up your profile, and you can easily click on your favorites and what you want to attend. You can go in and add and delete at any time. And honestly, it took me about 15 or 20 minutes to do. I had really no clue what I was doing, but I did it, and it was very quick.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I understand there's going to be some kind of light types of things as well. Obviously, we mentioned some of the social networking events and so forth. I mean, the conference, you know, every year certainly has like, you know, a major dinner program and dance and things like that. I don't know if there's going to be virtual dancing, but if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. We will have the gala, and the gala will be really to highlight the awards. So click onto it and please be able to congratulate each of our awardees. Also, to close off the conference, we are going to have a live toast and reception at the very end, to be able to, you know, kind of share what went well, what didn't go well, and most importantly, to congratulate all of our awardees.
Very cool. Well, I understand that through signing up and doing the virtual conference, you're going to have access to this content for, you know, at least a couple of years or something like that. But what we're emphasizing here today is the fact that it is a real-time event. I mean, the world in 2020 is increasingly real-time online. Hopefully, many aspects of this are just temporary, but no doubt we will. This is going to be a new part of our world going forward in terms of, you know, future events. Also having large, robust virtual components, even when it's going on real world as well. And I'm sure that's something ACRM and other conferences are going to be thinking about.
I think one of the things that's going to be really nice is when you always had those two sessions that you always wanted to go to, and they were at the exact same time, just as you just said, Dr. Fox, we'll be able to have get there, and you, in the comfort of your pajamas and at home, you can see the session that you couldn't see during the conference time. So as you said, we'll have access to it for periods of time, be able to really go and get it, different areas of science that you wanted to know, including our posters. Our posters also are going to be recorded so that you can hear from the authors about their posters. We're also going to have some fun stuff. We have some trivia contests, and I'll announce that at the closing reception. So stay tuned. We have lots to celebrate, and it's a new world, but hopefully we're going to do the best that we possibly can and always bring us suggestions for the future.
And another milestone, this is officially the lowest carbon footprint ACRM conference of all time. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Roberts, for joining us today on the RehabCast. I hope this entices everyone who hasn't quite signed up just yet. And certainly, you can't still do it quite up to the last minute. I understand the registrations are quite high, and hundreds are expected at many of the sessions. And you, too, can be one of them.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's it for the October 2020 edition of RehabCast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please share this episode with your colleagues, and please join us for ACRM 2020.